CliffCentral.com.
Yep, it is Monday morning, CliffCentral.com, just after 7 o'clock, and Leanne's here, and Mash is here, and we've got lots to get to. Who are you talking to, Mash? Who was in the background there?
I wasn't talking to anyone, but I was actually thinking about what Dr. Hanan said.
Were you not just chatting to someone else in the studio, or are you on your own and you've gone a bit crazy?
Yeah, I talk to myself quite a bit when I'm alone. It happens quite often. But I was thinking about what Dr. Hanan said, and I thought to myself, that is true. Mm-hmm. That is absolutely true. The fact that nowadays it's so easy to get a date, it's so easy to meet someone online, and it's so easy to have options, that people don't value any type of connection with anyone. And people take decisions with their hearts and not with their heads. It is so true. And I also want to address, with that said, the people who say I'm always lying when I'm going on all these dates. Well, first of all, I am sorry. I am so sorry if my standards and the level that I want to see myself at
operate
in a relationship. in a relationship is too high for you guys, but it is what it is. It is what it is. You have to filter out all the frogs.
Don't take anyone else's shit. Decent. Good for you. Mash knows what he wants.
I don't take nobody. One little mistake and you're out. On to the next one. So I don't mind going on 3-4 dates until I find that right person. I'm looking for a long-term partner. Not someone for the weekend. Not someone for the week. For a long-term partner. So it is quite a process. It is quite strenuous. And yeah. And I'm willing to do it. I'm willing to go on that journey. So,
we had a really interesting conversation on this show a week ago when Leanne was telling us how she felt about that woman who was like busting other people's relationships and, you know, putting them out. Mm. Remember, Leanne, you were quite like, you had some very strong opinions on that. And now I'm only just trying to figure this term out myself. So reverse catfishing is what they're talking about. And they're saying people are doing this now on dating apps. Reverse catfishing.
Mm-hmm. So remember, catfishing is generally posting photographs. Look, the severe catfishing is when it's a photograph, not even of yourself, and you develop a relationship with this person online.
Mm-hmm.
But the generalized form of catfishing is where you kind of take the best photographs of yourself, or even photoshopped or filtered.
You misrepresent yourself.
And then the person meets you and it's a bit of a letdown, you know. And now what people are doing is a bit of a trend now is reverse catfishing. So using their real photographs, but just not like highly glamorous photographs. Just maybe even unflattering. That, you know, they don't want to oversell their looks. They want someone to be interested in who they are and attracted to their personality.
Mm-hmm.
So some people are finding that works quite well.
Reverse catfishing.
Yeah.
I like
so
that.
you end up going on a date and the person's quite.
You see, I didn't think that was what reverse catfishing was, because that sounds quite sort of, you know, sweet. It's like, okay.
Yeah,
it's not a dishonest, you know, terror, because catfishing is dishonest, basically. So,
yeah,
it should almost be called negative. I mean, I know I'm picking, you know, at tiny little
the language.
Yeah, but still, to me, reverse catfishing is like a horrible thing. It's like catfishing, but even worse. You know, it's like that's where like the victim of the catfishing starts to victimize someone else. It's like you perpetuate the cycle.
That would almost be like revenge.
Yes. Yeah.
Revenge catfishing.
Right, exactly. So that doesn't make sense to me. I really thought it was much more juicy than that.
Wow.
But you're saying it's just ordinary people posting ordinary pictures.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's an ethical question as to whether it's dishonest or not. But all you're doing is downplaying your looks. It's still, the photograph is still you. And then, so that's not dishonest.
Well, some people,
I like that.
Some people's glam pictures are a bit like a, you know.
Hmm. I like that. rather undersell and over deliver. I'd like that.
Yeah.
Similar to what someone I follow, she's a celebrity, Doja Cat.
Mm-hmm.
So her pictures on Instagram, if you saw her pictures, you'd be like, what the hell is going on here? She shaved her whole head, she shaved off her eyebrows. her pictures are so unflattering. They look absolutely terrible. And when she's on stage, when she's on TV, she looks like a completely different person. So I suppose that's also a form of reverse catfishing.
Mm, it is, by Leanne's definition, certainly. But there also, there seems to be this group of people in the world. It's not a group. It's like a whole bunch of crazy individuals, but they have similar characteristics that are trying to make themselves as ugly as possible. I was, you know, I was listening to your description of Doja Cat now, and I just thought, look, I haven't seen pictures of her. But if you see how some people go on the internet and they really look terrible with their blue hair and their 9,000 piercings all over their face. And you think, are you trying to look as ugly as possible? You know, I mean, reverse catfishing notwithstanding. Some of these people already have a following or whatever, but they just look like they are. They've tried to, like, they've shaved the one side of their head and the other side's full of tattoos. And then there's...
Table.
I know I sound like an old boring fart here, but, you know, pretty is
it's
still...
It's all gone to taste,
but
really.
Pretty is still pretty is still pretty. And pretty will always be the same thing.
By whose standards?
And, you know, they sold millions and millions of magazines over the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. And they knew why the one sold and the other one sold less. The one that sold less had an uglier person on the cover. Objectively uglier. That's how it works.
It's different now. It's different now.
Yeah. Nowadays, what is also objectively ugly?
Yeah. I mean, for instance, people have certain kinks, you know. It might be tattoos or half-shaved hair or a mullet or a fringe that sits up at your hairline. I remember right from a child playing games at parties, you know, like spin the bottle and things like that. And I was very attracted to this one guy named Gregory. And the only reason was that he had braces.
You liked him because he had braces.
Yeah. I'm like attracted to that. And even still now, where it suits the person, I like a grill.
Oh, really? You like a grill?
It might be a tattoo thing. It might be a piercing thing.
Okay.
Really, to some people, those people are not ugly at all. Mm. I mean, you might think that the blonde-haired, blue-eyed, tall, skinny girl is the ultimate sign of beauty. But That was invented by the media. You know, what about the people who like the Kim Kardashian?
If you say so.
By the way.
Yeah, Kim Kardashian.
So there is a bit of an uproar in the body shaming and body acceptance community at the moment again. And that's because
they've run out of food.
Kim Kardashian and when Kim Kardashian and the likes thereof came onto the scene, the Brazilian butt lift, you know, was a big thing, the BBL, even though it's the most dangerous procedure. Curvy bodies were accepted. The curvier, the better. And now the Kardashians are apparently reversing their BBLs and have all lost tons of weight. So, you know, they've kind of got these indented skinny arms and the community is not really happy about that. It seems like the trends are changing again. But they always have. You know, Marilyn Monroe, for instance, who was an absolute icon, was not skinny.
But let's not bullshit. I'm talking about a healthy look, and a healthy look can't be too skinny and you can't be too fat, full stop.
The thing is, Gareth, you know,
Mash said earlier, you know, he's going to filter out the rubbish. He's not going to just date anybody. I mean, to me, when it comes to beauty, that's an easy call to make. You know straight away. Like, I've seen people who are a little bit skinny or a little bit fat that are still pretty. They're beautiful people, right? It's not just that. That's part of it. But you got to start somewhere and be clean. You know, like brush your hair and, you know, wash your face occasionally. I mean, those kinds of things matter. Don't you think, Mash?
Gareth, you know.
Is it too much to ask for a start?
No, the bathing part I do agree on, but I do remember a number of years ago, I used to think like you a bit, and I used to actually look at couples whenever I'm in the mall or just walking up the street. I'd look at couples and think to myself, what is she doing with him? Or what is he doing with her?
Right.
I used to think that quite time. Often. Mm-hmm. But as the years went on, I realized that, man, I'm just yucking other people's yums. There's somebody out there for everyone, and everybody finds something attractive. We live in a world where people enjoy seeing people shit on each other's faces. Everybody has something they're into, a body type they're into, a skin tone they're into, a type of odor they're into. Everybody has that. And it's fine. It is completely okay.
Then you and Leanne are on the side of the argument that there is no such thing as objective beauty. There is just subjective beauty, which is fine. Ooh, I think there's a lot of that that's unfalsifiable. So it's a hard statement to you know, kind of argue with. But I think there are some things that are, you know, universally considered beautiful. Proportions, the scale of the face, the sort of alignments of features and that kind of thing across all cultures, yes, across all parts of the world, there seems to be some idea of what beauty mostly constitutes, you know, a regularity of features and things. These are things that our DNA informs us to do. You either like something or you don't, and you're not sure why. Could be as deep as your DNA, but I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to. This is not the hill I'm going to die on. You know that objective beauty exists, and that's absolutely true. And this is where I'm going to fight you to the death, because I don't know if I believe it myself. And I do think subjectivity is a huge part of this, right?
Hmm.
Carl says, absolutely. "Hang on, you guys aren't shitting in your partners."
Oh, not this week.
Oh my god. Yeah. Marco says there are some gorgeous people with disabilities. Yeah, but he's just talking about himself now. He's just talking about himself in his wheelchair or whatever, looking for attention.
I like that, yeah.
No, it's true. And these models with conditions like vitiligo and you know, extreme freckles, and I'm just so glad to see that they're being embraced by the majority of people.
I love that.
Normalizing, you know, what we are supposed to look like. It's a lot less pressure. But along with this trend, just to get back to the depressing part, are low-rise jeans, which have made a comeback amongst the youth, you know?
Uh-oh.
That's what I grew up in. Low-rise jeans that barely covered your underwear.
But I'm saying, because low rise plus big ass, which was the subject of the, you know, the Kardashian discussion just a moment ago. It's going to be some spillage. there's going to be quite a lot of crack showing. Oh, there's going to be a lot of crack showing with their ass, especially if they're low rise jeans, right?
A lot of muffin topping. Oh. I don't know. Somebody in the fashion industry, in the media, is trying to make all these things come back again. He's like, heroin skinny type Kate Moss looking girls with low rise jeans. But I tell you, the depression amongst Gen Xers like myself who grew up wearing low rise jeans, there's this general outcry of, you know, life's coming to an end. It's come full circle and now we must all just die because the low rise jeans are back.
Shame.
I watched a video that one girl had made of a pair of low-rise jeans entering her living space. Like, she was sitting doing work and these low-rise jeans come in and sneak themselves out of a bag and start strangling her and haunting her at night and standing over her bed.
Well, did you keep any of yours from when they were still a thing?
No, definitely not. I mean, let's be honest, those are probably the most changed item of clothing when it comes to fashion.
Jeans.
The most fluid.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yes. If you kept some of them, they would be collector's items now.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, but didn't we all hear our mothers saying as girls growing up, oh, I used to have that exact belt. I wish I'd have kept it because it would have been like proper vintage and you could have worn it. And it's so funny how, as a young person, you think that you're breaking trains and it's something new, but you're just repeating what everyone else has done.
Not at all.
Yeah, I'm also. And I remember. Go ahead, Mash.
I used to actually have a pair of low-rise jeans.
I know. Disdain.
So my mother bought me a pair of jeans, and she thought they'd suit me. She just bought me a pair of jeans while I was in high school. This was years ago, like grade 8, grade 9. I was like 14, 15. She bought me a pair of
low-rise jeans.
Yes. Yes again.
She bought me a pair of low-rise jeans, and I wore these jeans until about grade 10. For about a year and a half, 2 years, I was wearing these jeans to every civvies. Every time I'd go to church, I'd wear these jeans. And I did not realize that they weren't men's jeans for 2 years until one day a friend of mine, I'll never forget him, Jason, actually in high school, grade 10. He's like, Mesh, aren't those Mesh? How do you pee out of those? Mesh, these jeans. And the turns out, jeans. Yep, I was wearing low-rise jeans. That's like low-rise women's jeans for about 2 years.
But I mean, so. You obviously thought they looked good on you. Otherwise, you would have found another pair or thrown them out or said, thanks, you know?
Yeah. They looked cute. My ass was popping. I looked really good in them jeans. So I would actually get another pair now.
Okay. All right. That's Mash. Mash is single-handedly going to bring it back in South Africa. The low-rise jeans. He's gonna be gender bending. Hey, speaking of which, this Harry Styles and who's the other dude? The other actor, man. Timothy Chalamet. Timothy Chalamet, I think is his name. So the two, he and Harry Styles, are now like in this big competition to see who can wear more women's clothing. It's supposed to be a thing, but this is not new. People were doing this in the 60s, 70s already. Sorry, guys.
David Bowie.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
You're not the first to do this, and it's not interesting. And also watching you two do it is really boring and stupid. Just got to say it.
Charlemagne.
I can never remember the guy's name. All I know is him from Dune. But he's the toast to Hollywood at the moment, apparently. Everybody just loves him and wants him in their shows. Listen, just quickly, from the sublime to the ridiculous. We were talking about the Kardashians just a second ago, right? They keep coming up, even if you can avoid. It's like when you've got Lebang on and air fryer doesn't come up. It would be weird, right? So if Lebang doesn't talk about the air fryer, like and subscribe, because at least she taught us to make it useful. Or was that you, Leanne? So the Kardashians came up, and you've got the story now. Is it true that Kris Jenner has finally been outed as having arranged the whole sex tape? Just what we thought.
Yes.
We thought that
exactly
these,
as we thought.
There's no way these vacuous idiots couldn't operate under the aegis of the great Kris Jenner. She is the power player. She made it happen. She was willing to basically have her daughter pounded on camera because she knew that'll make the whole family famous and important, right? That's what we're finding out.
Gareth, right? That's exactly what we're finding out. So let me actually give you the scoop.
What kind of so, people are these? Carry on.
Kris Jenner was on James Corden's show last week, mm-hmm. and she took a lie detector test where she was asked about the sex tape, between Ray J and Kim,
mm-hmm.
which was released in 2007.
Long time ago.
So it's quite old.
Yeah.
Long, long time ago. And basically they asked her, were you involved in the making or distribution of the sex tape at all? At all. Remember back then, social media was not that big. These are the days of like your MySpace, and either way, they were not that big. So for something to spread like a wildfire like this, especially explicit content, it took a lot. It wasn't as easy. It had to be quite well distributed. So she denied it on the lie detector test. She said, nope, I wasn't involved in this at all. And then Ray J goes live on Instagram, because he realized that when she said this, it made him look fully responsible for the distribution of the sex tape, and he came clean. He exposed the entire Kardashian clan, especially Kris, and said that Kris was responsible for the distribution. They actually had a contract in place with Kim's signature, with Kris's signature, with his own signature, that he's going to actually post to also prove to people that, hey, hey, this actually happened. And to make matters worse, he says that Kris Jenner is so out of it that after they took the first, after they actually took the sex tape, she was like, I don't like the angles Kim is showing at. I don't like the way, do it again. They made another sex tape. She didn't like the angles again. She said, Kim's ass doesn't look as big as it is.
Oh, wow.
Do it again. They took 3 takes of the sex tape.
This is a mom.
They took 3 takes.
Just hang on a second. This is a mom. How is this different to forcing your daughter into prostitution?
No, it's not.
I don't think it's
well,
it's
I don't know if there was any forcing done here.
Okay, but you're coordinating her career in prostitution. That's what you're doing here. Mm-hmm. You're going to... It's a different kind of prostitution, but maybe a, you know, a kind writ large. This is... It's really deeply disturbing that a mom would do this to her daughter, even if she seizes it as a way for them all to make tons and tons of money. I mean, someone says here, the devil works hard, but Kris Jenner works harder. And that's that's exactly right. I mean, wow. Carl says, yes. If they organized the sex tape, why didn't they arrange proper lighting? Really bad resolution. Okay, I don't remember.
Well, they had to make it look...
I did.
It must look like a sex tape. It'll be obvious if it's... Yeah, it'll be obvious if there's lighting and 3D effects and credits.
Looking into the camera.
Yeah, Vincent says, I always said that Kris Jenner is a pimp.
I'm all about the proof. And even then, he may post these receipts, these signed contracts. You can make anything up on Word or on any
Linda says, program. Are we really surprised if this is true, especially from them? Yeah, you're probably right. We shouldn't be surprised. But that's, I don't know. I just always think, you know, no matter how bad your life is, you have to force your children to make sex tapes for, you know, to keep you as a family relevant and famous. I just think that's so sad. Ugh.
That is really sad.
It makes me sad. I mean, I've never been sad about the Kardashians.
Well, it worked.
Third try was the charm. You know?
Yeah. I had to get that scene exactly right. But still, what a story. That's just unbelievable. So well done to Ray J, though, for coming clean about it, because he must feel better. Because otherwise he would have been the bad guy, right?
Yes.
People would have said, he's, you know, taken advantage of Kim, filmed it without her knowing. Distributed it. Right. Sure.
So kudos to him.
Yeah.
Kudos to him. Mm. The third draft was the charm. Speaking of which, y'all should check out the third draft.
Oh, what a segue. What a plug. All right, go on. Plug your podcast. Go on. It's a new podcast with Mash and Simpiwe.
Yes, we just have candid conversations with all your favorite creators. And we named it Third Draft because the third draft is always the charm. You have to try something once, twice, and the third time it always works. Just like Kim and Ray J's sex tape. So check out our show.
All right, very good. So this morning I'm very, very excited to talk to TJ Stradom, who's written this book over here. It is called Chris Becker's Billions. And it looks like it's a real, I mean, I've just paged through little bits and pieces, but it goes into amazing detail and you kind of hear what Chris said in meetings, and there are a lot of quotes from him in the book too. So he's really done an incredible job here. And amazingly, I don't know, we'll ask TJ in a moment, but I haven't seen too many biographical statements, works, articles on Chris Becker, even though he is an enormous juggernaut in South African finance, in South African media. And someone who I think, you know, we probably will all want to know more about. But TJ Stratum is a business author, a journalist. He's written and reported for Reuters, the Sunday Times, Financial Mail, and The Bild. His unauthorized biography of Christo Wiese scaled the bestseller lists in both English and Afrikaans. And then he decided, I'll stick in that area. I'll just go to a different wine farm, and I'll talk about Chris Becker and his billions. Isn't that right, TJ? How are you?
I think you summed it up perfectly, Becker.
No, well done on the book. First of all, am I right? No one's done a biography on Chris Becker before.
No, not a full biography. There's been some sketches here and there in some of those books that sort of took like a look at you know, several business people, but nothing substantial.
Yeah,
and I mean that's part of the reason why I did it. You know, how can there be nothing about this guy? And I mean, he had this outsized influence on South African business,
huge
wealth creation. I mean, the guy started Mnet. I mean, how could there not be a book about the guy who started Mnet?
Correct. He's an absolute genius, and you know, he also then took a whole lot of that money that Naspers had used in its traditional media asset world, and then he piled it into a deal with Tencent, which everybody at the time thought was madness. And he ended up taking that money and multiplying it by factors of 100 times in some ways.
It was gutsy, no? They invested in $80 million in other Chinese ventures at the time, mm-hmm. and it all came to naught. So then they piled in $32 million in 2001, dot-com boom, dot-com crash, you know, just sort of at the time when those two were separating.
Yeah.
And, you know, they sold the first little sliver of that in 2018, pocketed $10 billion, sold another sliver 3 years later, pocketed $15 billion. And they're still sitting on a stake in Tencent with more than $100 billion. So, you know, that's from 32 million to, let's say, a round number, 130 plus billion. That's a pretty good investment.
You know, these numbers are big. And that's the thing about Chris Becker. He doesn't think small. I mean, just the bits that I've gleaned, and I tried to read the whole book. I'm fascinated and gripped, and I will finish it, but I'm about two-thirds of the way through. And the amazing amount of detail that you've managed to garner here about the things that he says, the interactions he's had with other people, people who've spoken very frankly to you. Was there any resistance from, I mean, either Chris or people who know him well, who worked with him, to share this information with you? Because he's quite a private guy by all measurements.
Yeah, plenty. No, so this is an unauthorized work. So
sure.
I gave Chris an email, send him an email, and you know, just ghosting basically. And after that, I gave him a call a few months later, and he said that he's in a fortunate position. He can still go to the shop, buy a loaf of bread, and no one knows who he is. so It's not going to be the same now if the bread shop's next to the bookshop. But I mean, yeah. You know.
Well, I mean, listen, I think there'll be huge interest in his story. But let's just go back to those big deals for a second. I mean, isn't it true that at one point Naspers, and it could still be, was, I think, the fourth or fifth biggest media company in the world? And obviously it was largely as a result of their ownership of that Chinese Tencent stake with you know, obviously all the massive, massive network that they've almost got a complete monopoly on. Is it true that it was one of the biggest media organizations in the world, or still is?
Yeah, so they don't like the definition media company anymore, but they sort of, if you look at tech investors, it was in the top 10 by virtue of the fact that they were invested in what is now the best living. So, and they didn't have to pile a lot into it. It just grew phenomenally. But yeah, sure, they're definitely one of the top 10 players in that field. And, you know, media is obviously quite an evolving landscape. So, I mean, it's some of the things they're invested in, you wouldn't call media these days. I mean, they're piling billions into food delivery in other parts of the world.
Sure.
Billions into education technology, and billions into online payments, and billions into online classifieds. So, I mean, what's online classifieds? It's basically Gumtree, but in the rest of the world. So it's, and I mean, if you really think about it, because Naspers is the biggest listed company in South Africa, our pension funds and your unit trusts and whatever it's in NASPAS. You're invested in, and Tencent is, you know, what is it? It started off as a chatting platform in China.
Yeah.
And it's now the whole financial ecosystem where people do their full digital lives on it. So you invest on it, you pay people on it, you advertise on it, you do your social media on it. You know, it's like a full world in China. So these are the things that we're actually invested in, even though we don't know. And, you know, kudos to Quiz and his team for positioning that company to find that. Can you believe it?
No, I can't believe it sometimes. And I think about this guy who he didn't come from an extraordinarily wealthy family or anything. He really did all of this himself. And what do you think it is? Because when we hear stories about people who have made lots of money, we tend to lionize them immediately. Well, if they've made lots of money, obviously there's something special about them. They've got some secret sauce. They've got some intellectual or emotional ability that the rest of us don't have. I mean, in all of your discussion with all of the people that you must have spoken to when you put this together, and in your own understanding, I know you've had interactions with many of these people, all over the Stellenbosch Mafia or whatever you want to call them. These are the guys these are the guys who I think a lot of people, if you live in that world, they all speak to each other, they all know each other. But for you to get in there and ask these questions of these people, have you ever found that secret sauce, or is there no such thing?
That's what I tried to identify. So I built this book around 15 lessons, basically, that Quiz followed throughout his life. So it's not called a self-help book or an entrepreneurial book. It's a business biography. But the idea is there's these 15 steps that he followed, even though he doesn't say it is that. But I mean, if you read everything that the guy that was written about the guy, everything that he wrote throughout his life, if you do dozens and dozens of interviews with people who were close to him, and if you get rejected by dozens and dozens more who were close to him, you start to form a picture. And I identify these 15 things. I mean, and I think therein is the secret sauce. If you want to make billions the way he did, the first thing you have to do is make sure that you get a deal with your employer that pays you like an entrepreneur without having to take all the risk of an entrepreneur. I mean, he struck this amazing deal with NASPAS in 97 when he became the CEO, where he said, I don't want a salary. I don't want a medical fund. I don't want a pension fund contribution or anything. Just 3% of the value that I add to the company over a 5-year contract. And, he's had 3 of those 5-year contracts. It just turned out that the value that they created was about R1 trillion. So 3% of that comes to quite a bit.
That's nice.
That comes to a wine farm and some Maseratis for spare change.
There's this interesting man in the book too, Ton Vosloo, who was there right at the beginning of their ride together at NASPAS. So tell me a bit about him, because he sounds like an interesting guy too.
Ton's a fascinating guy. He's a newspaper journalist, was all those years. He was one of the guys who made Beeld quite a big power in South African media. And after being editor of Beeld for quite a while, he became the MD of NASPAS. Back then, it was called Nationale Pers.
It was a spin-off of it was like the government's communication arm in some ways back in the old days.
Yeah. A bit of Nationale. If there's Nationale in something,
for sure.
There's a stupid, I have a sniff. Anyway,
right.
So he was the MD of NASPAS. And we had a book launch the other day in the waterfront, and, as a speculator, I invited him to the launch because he didn't want to speak to me on the record. He just referred me to some of his earlier writings. And he pitched up.
Oh,
so
really?
So he told this story at the book launch. Yeah. I mean, someone asked me a question. I said, no, but we've got someone in the room who was actually there. And he tells a story where he was sitting at his office late, somewhere sort of December 83 or 84. I can't remember exactly now. And his phone rings, picks it up. It's a student phoning from New York, telling him that he wants to start a business in South Africa that looks a bit like HBO, Unbox Office, first pay TV business in the world, but it's all through cable. And it's Quiz Becker on the other line who was doing an MBA in the US at that stage. And he, as a final project, wrote this story, wrote a research piece about how you can do something like HBO, but not through cable. Try something else. You take a signal, you encrypt it, you encode it, you send it over the air, and then on the other side, you decode it. And obviously that works because we all have a decoder on our TV sets now.
So
encrypt, encode, decode, there's the decoder. So they, Ton Vosloo said, let's have a conversation. He sent someone to go and look the guy over. Later they brought him to Cape Town for a presentation. And of course, just wowed them. And they decided to back him with tens of millions of rands, get a whole consortium of press groups together. And that was the start of Mnet in the mid-80s. You know, they got a broadcasting license. And Mnet was initially a bit of a shaky start. But, I mean, if you look at it, eventually it was this phenomenon that changed South Africa.
For sure.
It was the first part. And this is what Ton also says. It was the first time South Africans could see people of different races on the same TV screen. It's just bizarre. You know, they were there as presenters together, whereas the SABC was towing the National Party line and doing that. So it was this breath of fresh air behind a paywall, but still a breath of fresh air.
You see, people don't understand. We didn't have free TV in those days. There was SABC and that was it. And, and each I remember we could get BOP TV sometimes. You had to just fiddle with the aerial a little bit. But that was
that was
run by the Bophuthatswana government. And they were the only ones who really turned it into a proper, you know, powerhouse. They had advertisers, they made money. But really, Mnet was the first channel that was subscribers. Like, we'll subscribe, we'll pay. And if you don't pay, you get open time. You know, like there was a window where they would show off to the rest of the country.
5 to 7, wasn't it?
This is what you're missing. And that was such a clever way of getting people to then subscribe. And that's obviously where, you know, out of Mnet comes all the other channels and DSTV and MultiChoice and all the rest of it too. But that was really Kurse's brainchild.
No, absolutely. And later on, they used Mnet or this pay TV business as a clever cash cow to generate the money to invest in other things. So, you know, they took big punts on the internet in other parts of the world. So, of course, identified the internet as a thing to invest in, and the Far East, China specifically, as the way to go by the late 90s. And then they started shoveling money that way, and, you know, some of it stuck. Of course, his famous saying of his is, you know, the strategy for investing in tech is throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what sticks.
Sure. Yeah.
Tencent stuck.
But I mean, they've made some very clever investments. But as you say, it's never a perfect game, right? There are going to be some bad ones along the way too.
So there's sort of two things that caused it. So they made a few bad investments that went to naught or, you know, drained money for many, many years. But, you know, the other thing is also if you're in that space, you have a lot of deals that come across your table. So there's opportunities that you did not invest in that you later see, you know, turn into something incredible. Of course, they turned down an investment in LinkedIn early on, for example.
Imagine that.
Alibaba, they turned down early on. You know, smallish investment in Alibaba, but still. They were actually invested in Kuro and the schools group at a stage. You know, that's small fry compared to the rest, but still. They pulled back. There's quite a list. If you take the back of a cigarette box and you write that down, one of the misses, it also comes to about $100 billion.
Sure. So,
and then
go ahead, Mash.
Yeah. And then TJ, are there any investments that you can tell us about that didn't quite work out?
Must be plenty. Yes. That
because it can't all.
He just said now that one of the ones they missed. I mean, if you'd missed Alibaba, at the best moment, LinkedIn. I mean, those count to me as losses, don't you think, TJ? I mean, those are the biggest losses.
Absolutely. But yeah, you know,
I thought Mash was going to ask you for investment advice there for a second. I was going to say, you poor man, you're about to go down. But he's asking about the losses.
That's my
next. I was just about to say. I was just about to put this a disclaimer out. Whatever I say can't be taken as financial advice. Can't speak to your financial advisor.
I'm not exactly.
A service provider. Just about to go. So they invested, for example, they piled more than $400 million into Brazilian print and pay TV investments in the early 2000s. Now, you know, that kind of money is big for any South African journalist would tell you. There hasn't been that kind of money floating around in South African media for a while, specifically in the print. So good for that. And it also basically went to naught. But what some of those failed investments did is it opened them up to new markets and got them chatting to regulators there and got them into that, you know, sort of that hotbed of investment. So out of that started that Brazilian venture was sort of the start of getting into food delivery. And, you know, Naspers now owns the biggest food delivery business in Brazil. iFood is a world leader in the Latin world when it comes to food delivery. Now, whether that will make profit eventually, you know, parts of their food delivery businesses do make a profit, but you don't know if the whole thing will. I mean, I tend to think usually when people bring me food for not too much more than I would pay going to get it myself, I'm not sure whether that's a great business. It definitely doesn't sound like Mnet where you get a subscription income and your costs stay the same, even though your subscriber numbers go up. So that's a great business. But, you know, it's maybe the other way around.
What kind of a life does Koos Bekker lead? I mean, you say he goes to the bakery and he can buy bread, you know, and nobody recognizes him.
He can go to the bakery and buy the bakery if he wants to.
Yeah, he can do that too. But what kind of a life does he lead? Is he mostly in South Africa? Are they? Because you don't see sort of flashy stories of Koos Bekker, you know, on a yacht or buying expensive apartments in New York or London or whatever. So no, we don't really. We don't hear these stories about him at all.
I remember one experience. Well, my only experience with Koos Bekker. I was living in Cape Town, and my partner knew him. And we were in a basement of a tiny shopping mall doing everyday things. And he was there too, just getting into his car after he'd been to the shopping mall to do something normal. And that I didn't know who he was. So, when your partner says, hi, how are you doing? Shakes his hand, introduces you. You have no idea what sort of status that person carries. And we got into the car afterwards after I'd been like, twirling my hair and playing with my flip-flops. That was Koos Bekker. And he didn't have this big flashy car and a huge entourage and security. And he was just living it normal, you know?
Wow.
He has some lovely properties around the world. But as far as I know, there's no supercars that I've ever seen him photographed in, for example. But and it also tells you something about a guy. I mean, if you take a photo of yourself in your Ferrari, you're different from a guy who just owns a Ferrari. There's always a little bit of something. Mm. Anyway, so I've got a chapter in a book called Publicity is Your Frenemy. And over the decades that he's been in the public eye, in effect, he's played it so well that he's not a flashy celebrity. I mean, if you compare him to Elon Musk, it's like two different things completely.
Mm-hmm.
But he has lovely properties. There's this he's got this thing in the Cotswolds in the UK called the Newt, which is a very farm luxury place to go to, similar to Babylon's Tour in here, but you know more of a British vibe. But, you know, look at it from the outside; it's more like Downton Abbey. And I mean, he, according to rumors at the time, which I couldn't confirm. he outbid Johnny Depp for that place. Johnny Depp was also interested in the same spots. It tells you a little bit of something. And I mean, that would have been, that's the era when Johnny Depp and Amber Heard would have. So I mean, that the house could have
had a very different story.
On it now.
But wow. TJ, so
is he clever in playing it? Yeah.
Is he mostly in South Africa or is he mostly in the rest of the world? I mean,
so yeah, that's the part of the question. So. From what I gather, I invited him to the launch last week too, and he actually replied then and said, no, he's traveling in Europe. The way I have it, he has citizenship somewhere else too, so he's mostly outside. But I think most of the high net worth individuals have they're mobile in an international way that.
They don't really belong to any country. It's more which tax jurisdiction. You happen to be visiting.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, don't we all wish that was the case for us?
Oh, yeah.
And CJ,
every day.
I'm interested to know, on you know, moving away from the whole subject of the interview to you and your writing, what is the process for you like on a book like this where it's kind of needs to be a heavily researched topic? Do you do all of this yourself? How long does it take you?
Yeah.
Do you get doors shut in your face when you're trying to find out information? Are you focusing only on this book at a time, you know, one thing at a time, or is it integrated with other things? Just those sort of, I'd just like a picture of how difficult it is.
Yeah, like I actually always like answering questions about the process because, you know, I think that's sort of interesting about a writer's life is how they do it and what else is going on. So, yeah, doors shut in your face, not so much more the sound a cell phone makes when it's being put down in your ear. It's not a sound. It's just you keep on pitching the interview to someone into the thin air. But, so this project took me, you know, let's say 3 years, but it's difficult to say it's a full 3 years because, you know, it was the pandemic. So a lot of the people I wanted to speak to were baby boomers. So it was difficult to get to them before there was a vaccine. It was difficult to do some of the regular things. You know, a wonderful resource in South Africa is some of the archives that the newspapers have. Some of them are run down, but I mean, you have to go there in person and, you know, rummage through all of that to do a proper media study to start with. Mm. Some of the magazines and the newspapers aren't there anymore. They're not well classified. It depends on which one of the media houses you talk about. And for that, I then sometimes go for the National Library. And, you know, those things were closed in the pandemic. So it took a lot longer. So when I wrote the book about Kirstavisa, that took me about 9 months to a year if you take it all into account. And I think the full-time part of this quiz back and book was probably also closer to 9 months, even though it was low intensity for longer periods of time. In between, I do some freelance work for, you know, media publications. I do some ghostwriting, you know, whatever can do to keep the pot cooking. I mean, but, you know, the main passion is this thing. And almost the longer you have, the more things unravel, even though you're only busy with it sort of low intensity. Sometimes leads take months and months to come back or interview requests or... And the funny thing is you also learn a lot from people saying no, they don't want to talk to you. So if one person says, no, I don't want to give you an interview and asks you, does Quest know about it? And then when I say, he knows, but he doesn't approve, then, you know, then it's one person. You think, okay, that's fine. But when it happens 80 times, then you think, this is quite
it's amazing.
Yeah, it's a poll of people that have worked with him and what they then think of him and whether they respect him, whether they fear him. It's more something like that.
You know,
but yeah, the cash part is interesting because you then now have to sell books and a certain number to make a decent living, and that's always the difficult part because there's a big lag between you starting the project and finishing it, and I. Yeah, so now basically it's great to finally talk to people who've read the book and can give me feedback and see people buying the book or whatever. You know, it's a new part of the process that I was looking forward to quite a bit.
And who kind of assists you with any, you know, legal transgressions you might make? And do you sometimes sit and think, I'm writing about this really powerful person? What could come of it? I would lose sleep over that.
So the thing is,
he relishes it.
Luckily, the publisher, luckily, they do some legal checks. So we sent the manuscript to a legal expert. It's sort of part of the process. And then someone comes back and says, "Listen, this, you know." Do we really need this paragraph? It might open a can of worms. Is there a way to rewrite it that you just don't do? Or they say, you just need someone to respond to this. So there's a legal check in school. You know, the other part of it, I mean, who knows whether my phone is being bugged, or whether I'm being being followed followed on more than Instagram. I don't know. It's something I live with. It's a part of our business, unfortunately.
But
it's not as cloak and dagger, I think, as some of the other investigative journalists in South Africa. They have it much worse. I mean, I'm just a man reading everything what another man wrote. And everything written about him, and talking to everyone that possibly knew him, and basically stalking his life, and then writing a book about it.
The byline is "The Making of a Billionaire," and I think people are fascinated by these stories. TJ, I just have to throw this in because Moonchild says here, "What about doing a book on Marcus Uster?"
Lovely.
Yeah.
You know, listen, if you can get to Marcus, that's sure. A great book to do. Mm. Dan, I did a bit of background work on Marcus earlier because I pitched a TV series.
Oh, yeah?
Which didn't get picked up, but still, there's a great story there if you dig deeper. I mean, I know a lot of it is out already, but there's a cool origin story there.
I think it needs
to be interrogated. So you need, you sort of need some. So I think the Marcus Uster one is an excellent question because it's a story that's not been resolved. It's not run its course.
Mm.
We now need something to happen. There needs to be some law enforcement action or whatever. So if something ever goes to court, that's the next part of the story. That's where you'll get a few people that will go to this court case if it's in Germany. And
because you don't want to tell the story halfway, right? And the best parts of the story may still come out. So when you're doing biographical stuff like you are, you have to really have a timeline in your mind. This is where we're going to end the story. This is where we're going to start the story. So to go back to Quirce for a second, because it really is it's an amazing story about this guy who he clearly has an incredible vision and an ability to make that vision into a reality. And, you know, he even says there's a line that you quote him saying there, before I was in business, the word entrepreneur was a French word and nobody used it. Do you think that he is the quintessential entrepreneur? Do you think he's... Because we're always looking for that perfect example. You know, people have always said, well, there's this guy or there's that guy or there's this one. And we can go through all the names and, you know, you could say the original Anton Rupert. You could say the Oppenheimers. You could say the Ackermans. Raymond Ackerman is widely regarded as being one of our best examples of an entrepreneur. But would you say Quirce is a different kind of creature?
Yeah, so, I mean, he definitely built one business from scratch into something incredibly successful that sort of has a lasting legacy. So there's Emmett for you. But later in his career, he was more sort of an investor or a guy who identified trends and then, you know, put some money behind it and saw whether it came off. And that's the throwing of the spaghetti and some of it stuck and some of it didn't. For me, the clue is usually if someone says someone is the insert name, surname here of that industry. So if someone says, oh, this guy is the Quirce Bakker of mining. Sure. He is the Quirce Bakker of, you
then
know,
you know you're
else.
Dealing with a top guy.
Yeah. And I think Quirce is there. I mean, he's got this track record. He's, other people in South Africa's business community see him as this incredible wealth creator.
Mm.
And they have from relatively early on. When he was 30 odd years old when he pitched the Mnet idea to these press groups.
Wow.
So within half a decade, he had this this reputation. And that reputation obviously sustained him for decades after, where people would keep on backing him. Now he's the chairman of Naspers, so he's no longer as involved as, you know, as management, but, you know, he still has a big say because they still have lots of high voting shares in the company, him and some of his long-term business partners. But, you know, I think a good rule of thumb is, you know, if someone says this guy's the Quirce or something, then it means the Quirce Bakker has this incredible legacy and people do actually say that.
Yeah. No, it seems to be that way.
And then TJ, Quirce's story is just remarkable. It is an absolutely remarkable story. And it's quite inspiring for me as well. Being a young person in South Africa, I'm actually thoroughly inspired by this. But I do want to know, what message do you want people to take from the book? So after I read the book, what do you want me to actually take home with me?
Yeah, I think the biggest message is basically you can change your entire, I mean, your position in life within your own lifetime. And, you know, of course, had good opportunities, yes, but sure. He didn't grow up wealthy. Or mm-hmm. He's not the son of a billionaire. He is a self-made billionaire over his lifetime. And he was a self-made millionaire before he was 40. Mm-hmm. And back then, a million was quite a lot of money. So sure. I think you can, you know, through persistence and through applying the right principles, you can definitely get there much sooner than you think. It's not all about winning the lotto. So, you know, in effect, investing in Tencent and getting that incredible windfall from that investment, it was like winning the lotto. But, you know, they positioned and they strategically put the company in a place, and himself with that deal with his employer, so that he gets 3% of all of the value that he adds, to benefit to the greatest extent from something like that. So I think the biggest thing is there's definitely some things that you can do that have been proven over time that are good things. I mean, if you're a young entrepreneur, mm-hmm. going it alone will take you a long time to build something. You then only have the resources that you have yourself. If you find a good backer, I've got a chapter in there, even backer needs a backer. Mm-hmm. You know, when you find the right person to back you or organization to back you, you can probably run much quicker than you would otherwise have. And then you build a reputation. Then you get bigger opportunities. Obviously, you have to make sure that you get remunerated in the right way. Mm-hmm. I mean, just selling all of your company and working for someone else, not great. So make sure to get that deal right. And, you know, that's why I try to put the thing, I try to structure it as 15 lessons. So it's still a biography in a sense.
Yeah. But it's also a business book. I mean, I think a lot of people are fascinated by, you know, the story of this incredible man's business acumen, which is why you've done a really great job, TJ, of laying that out as a big part of the story. But how close did you get? I know we're out of time here anyway. How close did you get to the private man, Koos Beckett? I mean, how much do you know about, like, his family or what kinds of things he likes to do in his spare time or any of that stuff?
No, so it's funny, over the years, you find unguarded moments by people, even if they are very private. So he would make a remark in an interview that just appeared in an Afrikaans newspaper that obviously he thinks that, I mean, maybe he assumed it would travel far, but it hasn't been run with. So mm-hmm. I got to see sort of I got a view into him through that. And, you know, unguarded moments earlier in his life. He was the editor of a student newspaper in Stellenbosch in the 70s. So I just read everything he wrote as an editor there. Hmm. Then you get to hear his voice. I found a school essay of his. So you get to know amazing what he research thinks like. Now, so and that stuff is out there. You just need to go and spend some time at the high school and the primary school, and it takes some time, but that gives you an idea of what the guy's like. And that's, you know, that's golden stuff. And, amazing. And, you know, early on, and I don't know, Gareth, if you, when you were young, you don't necessarily know you're going to be famous. So you speak to a newspaper, you don't know this thing is going to, it's going to sit on the internet or somewhere forever until you're 60 or 70. So you'd say something completely different as a younger man when you're unguarded and you're not PR'd up and whatever.
Yeah, of course.
Those things were incredible to find.
It helps. And it helps for him also to be at the helm of, or having had been at the helm of, one of the biggest publishing houses in the country, which controlled an enormous amount of what we knew and didn't know. So you can kind of, you have the ability, or certainly had at a certain time in the media, to really craft whatever narrative you wanted, or completely remove yourself from the story.
And maybe that's part of the puzzle, where there's not that much about there. But now there's a book.
Well, wherever you went to the schools, you went to all the trouble. So everybody needs to get a copy of this book if you want to know more about Koos Beckett. Koos Beckett's Billions. TJ straight on with us this morning. Thank you so much, TJ. Great to have you on the show. Well done on the book.
Thanks, Gareth. Thanks, Mesh. Thanks. Really
good stuff. We'll talk to you again soon. And yeah, I mean, if there's anyone who should be writing the Marcus Uister story, it's going to have to be you. You know these stories better than anyone else. Thanks so much, TJ. Good to see you.
Thanks, guys.
Cool. All right, everybody. That's all we got time for today. We will see you tomorrow. Have an awesome Monday. Bye-bye.
Bye. CliffCentral.com.